Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our consciousness and how we are becoming new and different human beings, perceiving new realities, and along with that is different ways of understanding the human being and who we are and what we can know about ourselves. So tonight I have a guest called Atma with me, who's developing the science of face reading. He's an industrial psychologist, and we're going to be talking about the principles behind this system of understanding a human being through looking at the face. So welcome to the program, Atma.
Thanks.
Do you have a last name? What is your last name?
My last name is DeGaint.
Atma DeGaint. Okay.
Atma was a nickname I was given because of my work and studies in Sanskrit.
Oh, but you're originally American, huh?
I am.
I see. So you were, how did you get into this science of face reading?
Well, when I first encountered face reading, it was through an introduction by a close friend of mine who was working with a certain Mr. Dr. Michael Lincoln, who I consider to be probably the father of this scientific approach to face reading. At that time, I'd gone through a very trying breakup with a girlfriend who was a movie star. And as I came to find out, she had slept with her director. Now, I know what you're thinking. How could I pick the one woman in Hollywood who would do that?
Right. Yes. So, yes.
So I was interested. A friend of mine told me about this, that he had been learning this face reading thing. So I showed him a picture of myself and the ex. And he looked right at the photo and he just said, oh, she's a man hater. Her unresolved anger towards her dad is causing her to sabotage all her relationships with men. And then he points over into my eyes and says, she's completely unequipped to deal with your level of intensity.
Huh. And you said, went,
okay.
What? How did he get all that from looking at the person?
Yeah, exactly. So he introduced me to Dr. Lincoln, and I began an apprenticeship with him. That was in the late 1990s. Mm-hmm. And since then, I've been trying to develop a systematic approach to understanding that process and developing studies around it for the purposes of scientific research.
Well, how did Lincoln do it? Was this intuitive on his part, or did he actually have a science behind what he was reading from people's faces?
He had a science behind it, and he never had the kind of funding necessary to really explore it in a sufficiently methodological way. But the story is pretty good. He was one of the early pioneers of using behavioral psychology back in the 60s for working with
B.F. Skinner, right? B.F. Skinner?
Well, yeah, that type of work, but then turning it into really clinical process, you know, a clinical practice. He was a teacher of psychology students at the University of Portland, and they were doing, teaching teachers and things like that. And he had remembered the work of two researchers from the 40s and the 50s by the name of Barker and Wright. And Barker and Wright had done this very interesting work on something called continuous uninterrupted observation. There's another technical phrase for it called idiosyncratic analysis. Mm-hmm. And functional analysis. And what they did, what these two did, was realize that this continuous monitoring created a very different sort of level of insight into the person. Now, that work never really went anywhere, but Dr. Lincoln was very interested in it.
Wait, can I just ask you a question? So they would continuously observe a person's face.
They weren't doing it just on faces. They were doing it on behavior. What they would do, observe somebody and write down everything they did in very tiny increments, like 1 second, 2 second, 3 second, without involving themselves with the subject.
You mean
right?
like
this actually came out later.
You mean like touched his face here, scratched his chin, do like little habits? Oh, I see.
Little tiny, exactly.
Okay.
This all became more popular in the 90s. They call it thin slicing now. And some professors from, I think it was University of Texas at El Paso, they did studies around this. And there's another lady who's famous, Nalini Ambadi from Harvard University. She's also a proponent of this idea of thin slicing as a way of developing better intuitive skills versus deliberative thinking skills. Right. And so, but back in the 60s, you know, nobody was really paying attention to that research that much, but he remembered it. And so I think the story he told me was that they were in the classroom. They used, I don't know, I guess some kind of closed circuit monitor or something. I don't remember what they did, but they were observing, teachers were watching somebody do intake interviews on these subjects. And for some reason, a subject had been left alone in the interview room for an extended period of time, and he was just sitting there, and there was still a camera on them, and they were, all the students and Dr. Lincoln were in that room doing that work, waiting for that to happen. And as they were waiting there, he had this idea that let's just try this continuous monitoring, this, idiosyncratic functional analysis. So they started writing everything that they could about the person's psychological profile, their history, what their family life would have been like. And the chalkboard just filled up, and somehow they had spontaneously developed this idea of, or practice of, psychological inference just by looking at somebody's face.
Wait, so they were looking at the face. Were they guessing about their background? I mean, how were they getting information?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it seemed like they were guessing.
Yeah.
But how it turned out was that they were able to create an almost absolutely accurate profile on the individual without having had the intake interview done. So they no questions had been asked. They just looked at the face, and they managed to come up with all the same information that then later came out when the interview was done.
Wait, could that have also been connected to some intuitive understanding of the person, as opposed to just looking at the face, like a kind of psychic intuition as well, you think?
You know, that's a funny question, because he says, of course, he always told me he wasn't psychic in any way at all.
Right.
But it clearly, it is, thin slicing and all this is about intuition.
Yeah.
It's about pattern recognition, right? These are psychology students and teachers who have the references in their head for what a person could have gone through, and somehow they are recognizing patterns in the face that match, you know, certain psychological conditions. And so it is an intuition thing, and actually this is what part of the research into it that's being done is, you know, how do we learn to tap into this in a systematic way? Can we learn to do this in a consistent manner so that we can use this as a tool?
Right.
And the reason it all, the other half of the story that we're missing here is that also in the 60s is that there was another big breakthrough in understanding the human face. See, prior to this in the 1940s, 50s, actually since Darwin, back in 1872, I think, Darwin wrote a book about the expressions of emotions in men and animals. And he had this idea that there was this universal experience of emotions that everybody shared.
Mm-hmm.
But scientists didn't really believe that. So it just sort of, that idea of his, that theory or hypothesis, just got set aside. And all the way up into the 1950s, social scientists thought that the human face was this amalgam of culturally specific, environmentally influenced responses. But there was this famous American psychologist, he was a theorist by the name of Sylvan Tompkins.
Mm-hmm.
And Sylvan Tompkins came up with things like the affect theory, script theory. Anyway, he had students, graduate students. One was named Dr. Paul Ekman, and the other one was named Dr. Carol Izzard. And unbeknownst to the two of them, he had proposed to each of them that they should try and prove that this was true, because he believed, Dr. Sylvan Tompkins believed, that Darwin was right. Ekman didn't believe it, but,
I think according to, mirror neuron theory, I think that is the basis of this phenomenon, that there's a common human expression that signals.
Sure, but this is in the 1960s. We didn't have anything like mirror neuron theory. And so they wanted to know if this was, Sylvan Tompkins wanted to know if it was true. And he convinced Ekman and Izzard both to do further research into it. And Ekman didn't believe it was true. He thought it was going to be proven, wrong. He thought Darwin was wrong. And so I don't remember the exact details, but he had some series of circumstances. Somebody from the DOD had grant money, and they needed, there was an opportunity to do a project. And somehow Ekman said, okay, I'll do it. I'll use the money. And he used it to go to Papua New Guinea, because he thought the only way to prove this idea as false is to find a pre-literate culture, a group of people that have nothing to do with the outside world, who could never have been contaminated in any way by our culture, so he could study their emotional expressionism. And he went there, and that study is very well known. People can look that up easily. But of course, long story short, he goes to Papua New Guinea, and he proves that humans are linked by a universal language of emotional expressions. And now, since then, there's been all sorts of evidence that's, deepened our, made it even more apparent that this is actually the case. But this has a profound impact on the possibility of this face reading concept. See, is if we take that idea, and we take the idea also that there's also been a lot of research that started back in the 60s on nonverbal communication, the way people communicate, without using words, right? And several anthropologists and sociologists did work on that starting back in the 60s, but there was two in particular that were very interesting. There was this anthropologist named Ray Birdwistell. And then another researcher named William S. Condon. And they were separately of each other, both doing work with film footage. They would like film subjects, because they were interested in studying behavior. And what they discovered is that even the frames of the film, they could detect movement in the human face at a rate faster than, 24 frames per second. And so that was fascinating to them.
Let me just integrate that. So you're saying we detect the subtle movements in people's faces quicker than, human beings in general, quicker than a film going in front of us. Is that what that study kind of proved?
That is exactly what those studies have proven. And there's been a lot of sort of further development on that. So clearly this concept is that there's this, Condon called it situation synchrony. There's this rapid kind of dance-like, almost musical-like communication occurring between humans. And the fascinating thing was that according to Dr. Condon, this interpersonal exchange of communication begins with the child and the parent 20 minutes after birth. It's immediate.
Wow.
And, so if you put all these pieces together,
let me just get that. Before you put those pieces together, is there then a natural reflex in the child to mimic facial expressions? Is that the natural reflex? And then
Several things. One, the child will mimic, but more importantly, the child will react. Since emotions are wired in, and they're not based on, they don't have to be learned. In other words, what Ekman's work and other research and emotions have proven is that we're somehow wired for them. And the face expresses them the same way amongst all humans.
But if a baby is just born 20 minutes old, it's looking at the mother, it can only react. It's not generate. I mean, what would it be generating? It must be, you know, learning right off the bat something.
But it's also, we also know that it's feeling. It's having emotions. It's feeling loved. It's feeling threatened.
What does it feel? Hungry, uncomfortable. Yeah.
Primal. I mean, we know that a baby is basically an animal.
Right.
Cognition hasn't been developed yet.
Right.
It's a stimulus response being. Right. But
right.
Animals, you know, it have emotion. Basic emotions are there. We see them. And that's part of what the research has shown, that when you look at the pictures of the babies, they're feeling, they can feel anger, they can feel fear, they can feel happiness, they can feel these very primal basic emotions.
Right. And then as it starts to study the mother's face, pretty much, then isn't the baby encoding, like if the mother's happy, the baby is mirroring that and understanding that emotion, or sad or angry, by mirroring the environment around it, and therefore kind of being programmed in a way by those around it to feel the things that other people are feeling. I mean, is that part of it too?
Exactly.
Okay.
No, that's a huge part. I mean, that's right on the money. Think about it, though. Whatever environment that baby comes into, it could come into a happy, comforting, nurturing environment. It could come into a stressed out, angry environment. It could come into a fearful, dangerous environment, right?
Right.
Whatever the parents are feeling, and it goes well beyond, and we've learned this from all of our studies of neuroscience, we know that it's not just what the exchange between the parent and the child that's affecting the child. It's the environment that the child is in. It's where the parent is at. The mm-hmm. child is picking everything up, right?
Right.
No,
I'm getting to the I'm into the whole environment thing, because I just had dinner with Bruce Lipton, whose whole idea about the biology of belief is that we're wired into the environment to react to it and be programmed by the. You know Bruce Lipton's work?
I do not, but that makes sense. There's another man whose work you'd be interested in, do by the name of Gabor Mate.
He works with addiction, right?
He works with addiction, and he wrote an excellent book on addiction. He wrote an excellent book on attention deficit disorder, and he's also has done really good work on helping us understand, you know, exactly what you just described, how the environment wires us to, you know, to be who we are. That's why the first few years are so crucial, because as we know, the brain, when it comes out of the mother's womb, fortunately for mothers around the world, is only a quarter of its actual size.
Right.
And it still has to grow so much over the next few years that all that wiring becomes absolutely fundamental to who we are.
But the
environment has huge impact.
But it's also how we understand, the facial expressions generate a chemical reaction that makes us feel a certain way. So we're understanding emotion by reading it through our own body. If someone look sad and we're mirroring that, we're feeling the chemicals of sadness that give us a sense of what that's like. So it's how we start to relate to the human condition or the human feeling through our own mimicking of chemistry. I mean, does that?
I don't even think it's necessarily, I don't know if I would, I think mimicry is only a piece of it.
Right.
I think there's mimicry, and then there's their actual response. Like they feel things, they feel primal, you know, emotions, and they might feel fear, they might feel happy, they might feel angry, they might feel whatever.
Right.
But the point is that what you're saying is exactly correct.
What I was saying is just how we understand.
Now, if you think about what you just said.
I was just talking about how we might understand other people by, you know, by reacting or sensing what they're feeling. But I know you're going off, but that's fine. I just wanted to see if that made sense.
I'm just saying, I agree with you.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's an important piece. That's part of tying all this together.
Right. Because
now, if we think about what we're saying, and that, they're sensing their environment, they're mimicking it, they're being affected by it, they're having an emotional experience based on the nature of their environment, right?
Yeah.
And that experience is usually fairly persistent. If you think about most people, whatever environment they pop up into, it doesn't change that much, you know, from day to day. It's not, you know, it's if you they get born into a crappy situation, it usually stays crappy for a while. Right. If they get born into a great, wonderful, nurturing situation, it usually stays that way for a little while. There may be changes, but they'll come over time, slowly, months, maybe years, not day to day. Now that's important because that child's face is registering all the emotional experiences. Right? The child can't help it. It can't pretend, you know, it's not going to, you know, repress its feelings and not show any emotional expression. No, it's automatic. It's having all the emotional experiences created by the environment, and it's repeating them over and over and over.
Right.
And because the same sets of muscles are used for every specific emotion, a pattern begins to emerge on the face.
You're saying an emotional pattern starts to imprint itself on the face. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And from that, like a constellation, it's not a simple black and white thing. It's a fairly subtle, you know, like maybe a piece of music, or I like a constellation of stars, you know, something that has lots of working pieces that create a new whole, right?
Right.
But what's important is because these patterns are being generated through our emotional nature, which is wired into us, this pattern that is left behind on the face can then be discerned. You can do a psychological inference on what you see and back into what that environment must have been like for them growing up.
Right. I get that. I mean, so I guess it can evolve over time, especially if you change your environment. But generally what you're saying and what the Jesuits have said, you know, you give me a child for the first 6 years and we control its life, its whole life, you know, from then on. So is that what you're saying?
I agree. Both are, you're both right. I mean, the first 5 years are crucial, and we know that from all the neurological studies. But we also know that the individual continues to adapt. Plasticity is a reality, and people will continue to change over their lifetimes. As I look at, I've obviously looked at a lot of faces, and what you see when you look at people longitudinally over their life is you'll see all the different changes they're going through. It's, matter of fact, it's extremely rare that I've seen a face that changes very little or remains fundamentally, you know, just exactly the same their whole life.
Right. Even day to day, a face can change, really, you know.
Yeah, but the underlying structure is deep. So day to day changes are, you know, more or less superficial. And what you're looking at is what's the long term sequence or set of patterns that emerge on a person's face.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I get that. So you're with Lincoln for a while, and then he started to understand this, and then but you went deeper than that. Is that what you're saying?
Well, he spent 30 years on this stuff, but because he figured this out in the 60s, I joined up in the 90s, so he'd already spent 30 years, and he wrote up a lot of stuff, but because he wasn't funded, because he wasn't part of any big university program, you know, from the 70s on, he's never been able to get properly, he's never been able to do proper work, in my opinion, and get published, right? I think his insights are extraordinary and valuable, and that's why I would call him the father of this whole scientific process. I mean, he pulled together work that other people, let's take, for example, Dr. Ekman. Now, he became famous as a face reader also, but he limited himself. He's much better at playing the system. He stuck to things that he could absolutely, study with a scientific method, and, you know, published huge amounts of work about the nature of emotions and the way they're, you know, show up on the face. But he didn't go into this idea of using of face reading as a form of psychological inference. So after I met Dr. Lincoln in the 90s, this was all sort of starting to come out. Like back in 2003, I think it was 2002, 2003, Malcolm Gladwell wrote an article for, what was that magazine he wrote for, New Yorker?
Yeah, I think it was the New Yorker, yeah.
Yeah, so he writes this article about face reading, and he writes about Dr. Ekman and this and that or the other thing. And I think, I don't know this for a fact, think that article or something like that prompted the Hollywood producer Brian Grazer to get really interested in the subject. So he ended up creating a TV show for Fox Network about a face reader, and modeling it on the work of Dr. Ekman. And I knew it was happening at the time because they had found me, and Dr. Brian Grazer's office had called me. I'm sure they just wanted to talk to Dr. Lincoln, but that's how I found out about the project.
What show was that called? What was the name?
It was called Lie to Me. It was on the air for about 3 to 4 years. Starred Tim Roth, I think his name is, the British guy.
Uh-huh.
British actor from Reservoir Dogs.
Okay. So, but getting back to your work, then you're also teaching people.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So, okay. Now I'm pulling all the pieces together for you. So, thank you for bearing with me.
I think it's important to lay out a history, especially, to get an understanding of where you're coming from and get a foundation for the whole science that you're developing and moving to new levels of understanding. So, yeah.
So bringing it all together, then what I've been doing for the last 10, whatever it's been, 13, 14 years, is trying to get a better understanding of how Dr. Lincoln did it and what is exactly the science behind what's happening. Dr. Lincoln, I think, is like one of those people who figured it out, was able to do it, but maybe he was never able to reverse engineer the process in a way so that we could, study it more systematically and teach it more systematically.
Right.
So that's been my interest, because you have to understand where I'm kind of up against a real, like, your people make a joke about face reading, and they do it understandably because there is a whole flurry of face reading information out there in the world, because it's existed as a speculative idea for thousands of years. You find it in Greek. I have found reference to it in every culture: Greek, medieval, European, Indian, Vedic, Egyptian, and Chinese.
Well, now, actually interviewed a Chinese expert, Gene Hainer. Do you have
right,
heard?
She wrote a book.
Yeah. Do you know The Wisdom of the Face? Do you know
of
Gene?
Course. Yeah, I don't know her personally.
Oh, you would love her, because to her, it's not a speculation; it's a science as well. And
unfortunately, yeah. I don't like their work at all.
Yeah,
I found all that work to be really scientifically unsound. Mostly, it struck me as pseudoscience. It really reminds me of phrenology,
which is arbitrary. They make up arbitrary ideas based on certain lines and kind of facial structure.
Yeah, exactly. So they have data that correlates, but those kind of correlations always tend to devolve into cultural bias, or they become a part of a confirmation bias system. And then, as we all know very well, that it can devolve even further into stereotyping, and then eventually racism, right?
Well, it can.
You know the history of phrenology, that's how that went.
I think you should just talk to Jean. She does Chinese face reading, but she's not Chinese, and she's an amazingly open-minded person and sees those cultural biases, but I think works around them. I think you'd have an interesting conversation with her, actually.
I'm always open, and okay. I'm trying to learn more and more. I'm just saying that's my initial,
I understand why you would say that, but I think she's on to something. I've interviewed her, and I think you would really learn something and also enjoy who she is, because she might not know the reasons why if someone has bushy eyebrows, they tend to be angry. But that's like it seems to be true, you know, or tends to have tendencies towards anger. I mean, that's another aspect of the face and things that you might not be tuning into, but those types.
I do look at this information. I have tried, and I am more than willing to be open, and I love meeting people and talking to people, and I certainly take your word for it about her. But and I know that Dr. Lincoln, he actually wrote a whole book that was based on his sort of extrapolation from the whole Chinese method.
Right.
And I have no problem with any of that because I want to approach these things as a scientist. And the wonderful thing about this type of a practice is that it can all be studied, you know, in a scientific way. We can certainly apply controls and scientific method, and we can determine, you know, are there components of the, you know, Chinese system that really do, you know, hold as causal and not just corollary, and is there a meaningful, you know, I believe all of that, if it's there, we can discover that, and I'm absolutely open to exploring.
And you're right. A lot of times it can be influenced by a cultural bias and devolve into a prejudice and a racism or whatever you want to call that. But, you know, I think there is a balance. But, yeah, getting back to what you discovered, because I like the idea of kind of creating or inventing a science based on observable facts and ideas. So this is where you're at in this area.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, my interest is to, like I said, right, so I'm looking at all these different branches and tributaries that lead that lead to this as an emerging science, and this includes a lot of study on intuition. I've been very interested in both reviewing and understanding, you know, the body of science that exists covering the topic of intuition, and that's leading to very fruitful insight into the fact that people are actually wired to be able to read faces, but are somehow incapable of it, which I think is really interesting. In other words, it's like saying you're supposed to be able to read faces, but something is blocking us.
But I think we do automatically. We intuitively may not be conscious of the fact that we're reading faces, but I think we actually are always reading faces and reacting to them.
I couldn't agree with you more. The problem is, how do we then take better stock of that information? How do we access the information that we're constantly getting from another person's face?
Right. Okay, so what's your approach?
Well, a big part of understanding the two main ways that we process information with our mind is, you know, breaking it into a camp of intuition and a camp of analytical or deliberative processing, right? In other words, the stuff you think about, mm-hmm, and the stuff you sense, but you can't put words on.
Well, that's that's a left brain, right brain sort of knowledge.
Yeah. I'm like many other people who study cognitive psychology, are not real excited about the left right brain metaphor.
Okay.
So I don't personally use it.
Okay.
I know it's kind of a handy shorthand,
right,
but I don't consider it a really, there's, it's not, I don't think it's a very clear thinking way.
All right.
Scientific way to describe it. But you get the idea. Intuitive versus logical.
Analytical. So, yeah. Logic versus. So, yeah. Okay. I get it.
And so the question, one of the things I'm really interested in trying to understand, and I do teach people these things, but I'll confess to you here that my real interest in teaching people is I'm trying to get more anecdotal insight into the process people go through. And so, because I need that in order to develop, just to design studies, you know, that I have no funding to pursue right now, but at least I like developing the studies and figuring out, well, how would we figure out what's actually going on? But the idea is, if you have intuitive thinking, intuitive processing and analytical processing, and how are they supposed to work together? Mm-hmm. And so there's been fair amount of interesting research now on intuition, and there's different models about the way they describe it. Some people talk about two separate processing systems in the brain working. Others talk about a kind of a continuum, like on a long continuum that from one end of the spectrum to the other, and the mind races back and forth. To me, that will, you know, science will develop deeper understanding of that. My concern is, how do we better balance between the two worlds? Because what you said, Alan, is, I think, was really correct when you said we're always walking around reading everybody and intuiting information about the world around us, right? Because we're wired for that. But that information, this ability to basically grok or gestalt or just experience massive amounts of information, doesn't necessarily translate over to the analytical side of the mind, where, which is where we actually need the information. That's where we get our insight into, you know, that's where we decide what to do and what something is, et cetera, et cetera. So what's the trick to creating a better balance between those two worlds? How do you make those two sides work together? And I feel like a part of what we have to do is understand the obstacles that are preventing that. And you could probably better than me describe all sorts of things from our culture, from our education system, that inhibit this balanced exchange between intuitive and analytical thinking. You know, our culture is very, very analytically driven, and they don't exactly teach us to create that balance when we're growing up in school. Right. I mean, that would be certainly a fascinating and educational process, right? If you taught kids to have that balance between the two.
Oh, absolutely. So, that's actually what we're missing, and that is actually why our civilization is sort of collapsing. We've become too analytical, and we've created a reality that is missing half of its, you know, way of processing information. And, you know, so we're missing our other half, and we've now reached a dead end with that type of interaction with the world. So it's where we're
about. You and I are exactly, you and I are on the same page. Absolutely. Yeah. Would you like to hear some of my ideas about how to work on that topic?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I was just at a meeting.
Like what I teach.
Yeah, no, I am actually just at a meeting where people were talking about the theories of evolution, and this is a major piece of our evolution. It's, you know, there's an Indian or a Cherokee saying that a bird cannot fly with only one wing. So it's like that. So,
exactly.
So, okay, tell me your theories. Yeah.
Well, I don't even know if I call them theories. Some of the practices that I am playing with in order to help people create that balance, because I'm trying, obviously, to understand it myself, involve the way one, I'll just give you one piece, as many different things that I've looked into, but one piece of this involves how we manage discomfort, how we manage emotional discomfort. When I look into the research behind cognitive biases, the way we cognitive traps and all sorts of different, you know, mental biases, one factor that comes up frequently is always the pain avoidance, not just physical pain, but emotional pain avoidance, the avoidance of emotional discomfort. Because who wants to be uncomfortable, right? Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think drives our propensity for analytical thought, the one-sided approach you just described, is that the one-sided approach, the analytical approach, offers that falsely generated sense of security or certainty. It's like, well, we know what something is. We can say what it is. We can label it. We can talk about things in a definitive way. And all of those things provide comfort. And for us to ask people to step back from that and say, well, what if things aren't as black and white as they look? You know, what if things are really always in a state of flux and constantly changing? And what if instead of being dogmatic, we all became dialectic and looked at things in a much more dynamic way?
Wait, can I just add, let me just ask you, I'm just like stuck on the pain avoidance is that we're hardwired to to not deal with emotional or physical pain. We tend to avoid that, but I'm just curious if somebody is brought in at a young age into an environment of pain or emotional trauma, and there wasn't a chance to avoid it, would they would then seek to perhaps go deeper into the pain in order to get through that onto the other side, because there'd be no avoiding it, you know?
I think that's part of how you get people who are what we call naturals in face reading, or naturals in super high intuitive skills, because they come into an environment where it absolutely requires them to do that. They can't hide from it, so they have to face it in order to survive. And yeah, it's not common, but that does happen. Of course, that's not a functional way to learn this process, because in doing that, they're creating all sorts of other obstacles and internal scripts and walls that, you know, are going to interfere with their overall functionality. But I think what you're describing does happen.
Well, I think it also is the, just a little separate aside, the role of the artist. I mean, artists generally do have tormented lives, but they can put this intuitive expression. And I think a lot of artists are natural face readers because they're communicating sometimes in portraits the subtleties of the human experience. Actually, it might be an interesting side note for you to look at famous portraits and see what you get from them. I'd be curious.
Oh, I do. I already have. You're exactly right. I agree with you completely, and I think there's a wealth of information in those.
Anyway, back to your...
But yeah. So this willingness to be, the conscious choice to choose discomfort, which is actually only really hard in the beginning because you're not used to it. If you were used to it, you could manage discomfort just as well as you could manage comfort.
Oh.
Because that's how the human brain works. It can adapt and learn to do anything.
So you're saying people are naturally avoiding discomfort, so they're disconnecting from their intuitive, so they don't have to deal with other people's discomfort that they're reading around them. Is that what you're saying?
Not only, the discomfort they're feeling, but just the discomfort of not, of being open to all this ridiculous information that's complex, because life is complex, people are complex, and our desire for things to be dogmatic or black and white or clear drive us away from like being willing to deal with the messiness of life's actual information.
Okay, I get you. Okay, so that's what you get the pain of. No, I think that's a really interesting approach. Was this your original thing, or did that come from Lincoln as well?
No, this is the work that, because as I said, I've been trying to blend my studies from Western psychology with Eastern psychology. And when I started back in 97, going much deeper into the Sanskrit texts and the yogic practices, I realized that the way most people were doing this whole yoga thing was rather silly, because they were using it as a kind of a pain avoidance process. And the more I read into the text, the more I realized these yogis were not about avoiding anything. They were about feeling everything. And it was their willingness to feel everything that gave them this extraordinary intuition, this extraordinary ability to be grounded, to be centered, and to start moving beyond the influence of their own mind. Because the mind itself craves pleasure, but they became not indifferent, because this is what people did. They misread the idea. They misread the indifference or the tolerance for discomfort as something you just ignored and repressed. But it's quite the opposite. They became absolutely open and willing to feel everything, pain and pleasure alike, equally, without, trying to grasp one and avoid the other. They just opened themselves up. And that's what gave them the ability to start moving beyond the influence of the mind, particularly, obviously, the analytical mind. And that's our problem, right? We're trapped under the influence of the analytical mind, and we don't have that balance between the analytical and the intuitive.
So you're saying all the time, I mean, on a subconscious level, we're reading the environment and it's giving us things we're choosing not to make conscious because we don't want to feel.
Yep. That's what I'm saying.
Okay, I get that. And I think, and I agree. I totally agree. That's where the
I work on different, I'm working on different practices, different tools, different ways to help people work through that process. I want to find out if can we systematically learn how to step out of that.
So your work is not so much about face reading, it's more about being present to the human condition, if you want to call it that.
I'd say in the bigger picture, yeah, because the face reading is really just a piece that I think it's a fascinating piece, but it's a piece of my overall work. My overall work is similar to yours, I'm sure, which is I'm interested in how do you advance the human condition? How do you expand consciousness? How do you help our society become more functional?
Well, that is what this program is about. That's why I call it New Realities, because it's my investigation into exactly that type of world we're facing about how can we advance to something
different. Important work. I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, I think it's what do I think is important? I think it's the only thing that interests me. I don't know if it's important. I mean, yeah, I hope it's important, but it for me, it's fascinating. And, you know, I search out for whoever is kind of doing that in their own way and pulling it all together in one place so people can then choose from a variety of ways of evolving. So,
well, I hope I am trying to do my tiny slice.
No, you are doing it. You're absolutely doing it. That's why I'm interested. I had no idea that's exactly what you did, but I guess I intuited it or something. But so, okay, continue if you would.
Well, that's the big picture. If I go from big to small with you for a second, the big picture in my approach to industrial psychology is to take I'm actually trying to take focus away from healing the individual as a singular entity and think more about what is the nature of our interactions, what are the nature of our institutions. By institutions, I mean our big institutions like our economic system, our political system, our education system, and our smaller institutions like our family, our neighborhood, our school, our workplace. And I believe that there are underlying dynamics that drive the function or dysfunction that exists in all of these institutions. And I know that, so that means I basically think that organizations, institutions have their own psychology. And then, of course, individuals have their own psychology. But between the two, I believe that the more powerful, more dominant psychology is the institutional one. Mm-hmm. And that the individual is, because of the nature of the way humans are and what we've learned about our adaptability and our neuroplasticity and all these things, the individual is supremely good at adapting to whatever the dynamics of the system require. Mm-hmm. So I find that it will be very difficult to make deep change by working strictly with the individual. Not that that's a bad thing, but that at the same time, we have to pay attention to the dynamics of our institutions, our organizations, and our interactions with one another.
Right. That's why the African saying is it takes a village to raise a child, you know.
Sure.
That the culture is really the main influence on how we develop on all levels of our psychology.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm with you. And the institutions are, well, and now they're breaking down. And now they're in the way of the very thing they were meant to create, you know, or facilitate. You know, the medical institution is in the way of health somewhat, and the educational system's in the way of education. Our religious institutions are in the way of our spiritual evolution. And so anyway, that's just a side thing. But
it's right on. Like I said, working from big to small, back and forth, you're absolutely right. You know, the dynamics inside of these institutions are completely dysfunctional. And
well, they got too big. They got too out of control. I mean, their original intention, I think, was for the right purpose, but they've lost their connection to the individual. I mean, they became just about the institution itself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Instead of being a conduit and a tool to advancing us as a people.
Right. Yes, yes, yes. So.
Yeah.
Okay, so where does that go with you? What do you do with all that?
Well, you know, the face reading is one piece of it. For example, I am writing and developing studies, and I don't know if and when there will be funding for the kind of research I'd like to do. But in the meantime, I am teaching this stuff to people because it helps me tremendously. It's sort of a selfish thing I do. When I share this information with the public through public lectures or workshops, I get feedback. I get real time, real people experiencing the different ideas, practices, the different ways I'm trying to help people develop intuition. So face reading just gives me a concrete tool to explore some of the things I'm interested in.
Okay, so, can you be more specific? I don't quite get how it helps you. I mean, maybe if you go into it a little more, I'll get that.
Well, teaching people how to be, like, for example, we have these websites, you know, how to be a face reader?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm sorry. How to read faces. I'm not a publicity expert here.
Okay.
It's howtoreadfaces.com.
Okay, that's right? Your website. Okay.
That's our website, howtoreadfaces.com. So I offer face reading services there and workshops and public classes in face reading. When people come to these events, I'm able to practice or teaching them how to develop their intuition, how to change the way they interact with their outside world. More than just changing them. And I know people come because we're all naturally a little, you know, interested in ourselves, and we want to make our lives better. But when they come and learn, for example, what I would teach in a face reading workshop weekend, I'm changing the way they interact with their outside world by teaching them to see it differently, to register information differently. And that changes them. It changes their perception of themselves in the big picture. One way I describe the way this kind of shift of consciousness is by giving them a figure ground perspective, right? Like a gestalt perspective, in which they realize that it's not about them being just themselves, a unique individual, separate from the world, nor is it about just trying to think of yourself as being one with all, right? That's a very big New Age thing, right? We're all one. Mm-hmm. But I don't think either of those perspectives is functional. To just simply think you're all one is not sufficient, and to simply just think that you're a separate, independent entity from the rest of the world is not efficient. What I'm trying to help people experience, although they're getting it in little bits and pieces of actual lessons and practices, but what I'm trying to have them experience is a paradoxical reality in which they can deal with being one with everything and separate at the exact same time. But that's a paradoxical thought. Doesn't do me any good to tell that to people intellectually. It's a captivating thought, but you can't do much with it.
Go ahead.
If you can guide people into an experience of that kind of a paradoxical phenomena, you know, this idea that you are both one with and separate simultaneously, that to me is a very fascinating shift in consciousness.
But if you're reading someone's face, like I was just looking at your website, there's a face here, Drew Barrymore, and you're kind of going over the general things, but how do you then merge with that? I mean, how do you take these kind of objective ideas and feel as if you're a part of that? You know what I mean?
Well, it's in the process of teaching you how to do that.
I see.
In other words, teaching somebody how to face read isn't a simple academic process. It's because you have to teach them how to blend intuition and analytical thought.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And that requires a paradoxical shift.
How do you shift do that? How do you do that shift?
Well, there's lots of different tools. There's different levels to the way I try to engage people, but I can give you a very simple exercise if you'd like.
Yeah, I'd like that, yes.
Okay, so for example, let's say right where you or your listeners were at this exact moment in time, whatever you're doing, whether you're lying down or standing or sitting, if you were to simply, in this moment, become aware of the physical experience of weight. In other words, the fact that you are actually an object of mass and therefore are under the influence of gravity.
Uh-huh.
It's a physical phenomena.
Yeah.
Don't think about, if somebody were to not think about it, not describe it, not analyze it, but simply physically feel it. Mm-hmm. In that moment that you do that or anybody does that, if I have you tied to a machine reading your vital statistics or your brain waves, it all changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a simple biofeedback mechanism. It's not, you know, voodoo.
Uh-huh.
We learned about it in the 60s, right?
But yeah. Yeah.
But that willingness to stop and choose to feel something as mundane and common and ever-present as the weight of your own body, mm-hmm, creates a shift, a mental shift. It actually brings you into what we call the present moment. Mm-hmm. And for a short instant, the mind snaps out of its sort of analytical state and it goes into this experiential state.
Yeah, I can see that. I did that, yes.
So if you build on that, and here's the fascinating thing, that if people were to take that simple exercise, just that one exercise, and build on it, simply through repetition, doing it over and over and over again, they would find that they get better and better at it. Each time they check in and choose to feel the weight of their own body, they'll actually notice more. And it's something you, through repetition, and the way we rewire the brain is through repetition, through the repetition of activities, practices, not through thinking or wishing, you know, or daydreaming. You have to actually do something to rewire the brain. And so that's one example, and then we can build on that. We can use other things like awareness of breath. And then we can take them into, I have an exercise actually on that website. There's a link to my YouTube channel. I have a YouTube channel. It's Face Reading, all one word, Face Reading X. And on that channel, I have an exercise in stream of consciousness writing. When you learn to do, and it's an old, you know, technique, but when you learn to really do stream of consciousness writing well, which is just nothing more than putting the pencil or pen to the paper or keys to the keypad and not stopping no matter what, just right, writing no matter what and letting it flow without controlling the outcome. So that's a similar exercise to the feeling of weight. You're not controlling, you're not defining, you're just letting an experience flow through you.
Right.
Well, I believe that stream of consciousness exercise is a very important one for helping people learn to just become comfortable with intuitive knowledge. Because the problem with intuitive knowledge is that in its current state, it doesn't make any sense, mm-hmm, right? Because it's too much information. The brain only processes tiny amounts of information at a time. Intuitive knowledge is huge amounts of information, so it can't make sense. But if you could help people become more comfortable with that, then you're, which is what has to happen in order to become a face reader.
But that is the purpose of art. The art is giving us the information that we're not getting in a linear way, and we're getting it in this bigger,
yes,
non-linear way. Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. No, I mean, I'm a huge proponent of teaching the arts and,
and
you know, art, meditation, science, spirituality, to me, they all blend into one.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And so, okay, so you're saying, we need to, I mean, I always like being overloaded with information because I feel I can create my own choice and put it together in my own unique way, but other people tend to limit their information, and but that's okay. I mean, so what do you do with all this then? You're saying
you were asking me, how does learning, like relearning to read a face, like you look at this face reading of Drew Barrymore and you're thinking, well, how did that help the person? Well, in order for me to teach you how to do that, you're going to go through these exact experiences, this art, science, art, consciousness, intuitive, analytical blending practice, you know, because you can't get there without going through that. And these are the kind of skills we want to learn more about. How do you teach them, right? So the research I'd like to see done in the future is on these very topics. How do we, can we understand this process, this balance, this learning to flow between intuition and analytical thought and go back and forth? How can we understand that systematically so that we can start teaching it to the children in schools?
But aren't you saying two different things, or at least I'm not integrating it yet? You're saying there's a science to it, and then you're, which is a logic, and then you're saying there's intuition, which goes beyond the logic. So, I mean, it sounds like you're saying it's both of those things, right?
Of course it is.
Yeah.
Just like being good at anything is almost always both of those things.
Oh, so you learn the skill and then you let the talent, the passion take over or something like that, right?
Yeah, you could put it that way. Yeah. Or, I mean, to be good at anything, it's never strictly an analytical process, whether you're a musician or an artist or a doctor or an engineer. You know, innovation, greatness, problem solving, it's this blend of creativity and knowledge, right?
Right. No, I agree. So you're teaching people really how to notice, you know,
teaching people how to be willing to notice. Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I like that.
Or Allen Ginsberg, the poet, said, notice what you notice. Or there was this wine taster. You ever go out with been around a really, you know, sophisticated taster of wine who would then point out, do you taste that dryness, that fruitiness? I mean, things that were there, but you didn't articulate or understand even until someone pointed it out to you. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's right. There it is there in that.
Exactly. Exactly.
So you're showing people those levels of subtle awareness that they may not even know exist, but capable of understanding cognitively. It's a cognitive science in a way you're teaching people.
Absolutely. That's a very good summation.
Okay, I get it. Because I've been studying cognition in terms of understanding art and seeing what is this artist trying to show me about something that could not be said but only shown and communicated through these images that go beyond the logic and linearity of words but yet impact people if you look at this image long enough. You know, it's like the artist is communicating from subconscious to subconscious, and I think in a way, face reading is sort of doing that too, right?
Absolutely.
Person's subconscious is communicating with my subconscious, and we develop unaware relationships and then reactions to the relationships because of these subconscious dialogues.
Yep.
Yeah.
That's very good, yeah.
All right, I get it. So, but it also seems like you have a matter-of-fact system, like if you know, the mouth looks like this or the eyes look like this. Is that true or is it different?
I think that I don't have that very much because I feel like that's the kind of stuff that kind of tends to lead you back down the phrenology road.
I see. So you don't have a general system for that. You have more like, what is this face saying to you now?
That's why I call it a process for psychological inference, which is really what you're doing.
I see. I see. But how do you, okay. So, I mean, I'm looking, I mean, how do you, but then it becomes subjective. You may think Drew Barrymore's right side of her mouth means this, but I might think it could be that, right? Or something else.
Well, it could be subjective unless it's not. So
right.
That's the thing we can study. We can test. Right?
Okay.
I've designed one study already that would, you know, let us prove one way or the other that if people learn how to do this, if I teach them how to do this and then they read faces, will they all see the same thing in the same face? Because if what I'm saying is true, they will. And it won't be so subjective. It'll be a little bit objective, right?
Okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah, I'm with you. So go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just wondering if how you could teach me, I don't know, about in 5 minutes, but how you could have me help read someone's face. Well, of course you've been doing it and you have a sophisticated awareness of it, but how you do that?
Well, I think that the simplest thing, a simple, simple way to begin, and it is obviously, I believe this is learnable and mm-hmm. teachable. Obviously, that's the premise of my work. And it's not easy. I don't know if you've had medical training. I've had some, but very not enough so that if I look at an X-ray, mm-hmm. it really means nothing to me. Mm-hmm. But if an X-ray technician or a doctor looks at the X-ray, mm-hmm. it means everything to them, and they see volumes of information in it, right?
Well, I do have to tell you, I've studied a lot of pattern ideas about patterns, and I think human beings are hardwired to see the subtleties of patterns when they're trained to see that, you know?
Exactly. So it takes training.
And well, let me just tell you one example, which was like blew me away. This guy, Wade Davis, he gave a TED talk and he talks about being out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean with these Polynesian people who are rowing. And this one captain of this rowboat says there's an island in that direction about 200 miles. And he says, how do you know that? Because they're in the empty ocean. And he says, can't you see the way the waves are hitting the side of the boat? And like, that's as subtle. That was such a subtle way of human beings understand these patterns that you could learn to read the subtleties of, something that detail. So anyway,
and I think that the human face is, you know, even easier to learn to read than the waves
right.
in the middle of the ocean. But based on the same principle,
right,
pattern recognition. Yeah, I think that's a very good understanding of it. So all right, so if I give you a simple process that can begin the practice, I would say do three things. One is you have to learn, the first thing you have to learn to do is check your agenda. Mm-hmm. You have to set aside your personal desires, what you want the person to be, what you hope the person to be, what you're afraid the person might be. So for better or for worse, you have to really set aside your desires.
So if I think this woman is really beautiful, and
you will not get a good reading.
I won't get a good reading because I'll be overlaying my projections and desires and all that onto this face. Okay.
Not to mention there will be drugs in your system.
Right. These chemical pleasure drugs. Yeah.
Yeah. So, right. So very difficult. So you have to learn, you have to develop your strategies for whoever it is, ugly, beautiful, scary,
right.
Attractive, whatever is going on. Set aside your agenda, drop your desires, and see if you can become, work from a neutral place. That's mm-hmm. why I work on all those different little practices, like the feeling of weight, the awareness of breath, all these things, because they help people go someplace that is outside of their normal, mental reaction.
So get neutral in where you're at. Just get blank and empty, which is what psychics and intuitives and empaths do in order to read somebody's field. They get empty so they can pick up what's coming to them, and they know it's not them. But, I mean, that's something else, what you're doing.
But it is something – it does begin in a similar place.
Yeah,
and then,
okay.
And then the two streams diverge, the paths
right.
diverge.
Right.
But it does, you know, because, and I think that not just a psychic has to do that, an artist has to do that.
Right.
A good police, officer has to do that. A good, you know what I mean? A good doctor has to do
well,
that.
Well, even in nonviolent communication, they say just make an observation without an evaluation, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, okay.
All right. So that's one, step one.
Uh-huh.
Step two is you're never going to become a face reader working with a live face, learning it on live faces, because it's way too much information, too fast, not enough time to be with it.
Right? I see. Oh, and plus it's always changing. The subtleties of the expressions are changing.
There's that, but not so much. That's not so much the problem. Really the problem, and this was one of the big discoveries that Dr. Lincoln made, is that each part of the face is indicating a different psychological perspective.
Really? Each part of the – so you could have a contract – like the face could be emanating two different
– Absolutely.
I see. That's what makes it so confusing, doesn't it?
It is. And it's just like if you turn on a bunch of TV sets to different channels, you get chaos. Your mind can't make sense of it. And mm-hmm. what do you think your mind does – when it can't make sense of something, it imposes its own meaning on it.
I see. Uh-huh.
So
is that also have to do, I'm just from the other side, the conflict of emotions that people have within themselves? I mean, if people were pretty balanced, would they still have that conflict in their faces? Or is that just true of people in general?
No, I think people in general are quite complex, and it's actually a good thing. And so finding a sort of true, really true symmetry from a face reader's point of view almost never happens.
Because people have
depth, and when you meet somebody who, not from a strictly physical plastic surgeon's point of view, but from a face reading point of view, who has real symmetry, what you find are really sort of shallow, empty, uninteresting people.
boring people.
Yeah.
I see. So it's the, That's a really interesting observation. So, okay.
So in that case, step two is cover up the halves of the face. Right?
Okay.
Left to right, top to bottom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that you can look at the face without taking in the entire face, because that's going to confuse you. But if you spend time with just the left side and just the right side and just the top and just the bottom, and instead of trying to like figure it out, because maybe you want to start guessing or knowing, which is always the worst way to begin the process. Mm-hmm. Instead, this is where I would say learn to practice unfiltered stream of consciousness. Just like cover up a face, so you're only looking at the left side of the face, splitting it right down the middle, center between the eyebrows, tip of the nose, center of the chin, left to right, and you write down everything you look at the right face, you just stare at it for a minute or two, and then just start writing without stopping. Poetry, words, colors, whatever. Don't try to figure it out, because the minute you start trying to think it, you block the flow of intuition.
Okay.
And it takes real practice to kind of let that flow. And so the unfiltered stream of consciousness, and the exercise I teach on the YouTube channel helps people understand how to do this. It gets that part of your brain going. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, once you've done that a few times and you just didn't try to make sense of it, but you just let whatever it was in you just come pouring out like this uninterrupted stream of nonsense or poetry or words or whatever, then you go on to step three. And you start looking at the stuff that's coming up, and maybe it surprises you, maybe it doesn't. But then step three, filter that information and start shaping it into a narrative mm-hmm. about who this person might be from this part of their face. You know, where are they coming from? Where are they going? See if there's any patterns that begin to emerge. And obviously, you know, I'm simplifying a process.
That right. I know. I know.
You have a fair amount of time to learn.
No. I know you give whole weekend classes on this, and I'm just trying to get a sense of it. So, but yeah.
There's a 1-2-3 process. That's a simplified, but at least it gives you an idea of how it could be approached.
Well, it's interesting, though, if you do this, that a lot of people would get the same thing about the same face. So, that's a really interesting part because it seems like it would be arbitrary, but you're saying it's not because there's
when they become skilled at reading the face, I'm confident you'll get the same results. Just like when doctors become skilled at reading x-rays, they all see the same thing because they have the training. So when we train up face readers, you know, they're going to see what's there. So, humans are complex on one hand, and on the other hand, you know, psychologically, there's a fairly finite amount of ways that we can talk about people's psychological stature.
So are you always reading faces when you meet people? Are you saying, hey, this is like this? I mean, you're walking down the street. I mean, are you just doing that with yourself?
Right. Yeah, it's pretty hard not to, although I'll be honest, I don't go very deep.
Right.
Unless there's a reason, like somebody asks me, I'm hired, I'm being paid. You know what I mean? If it's for research, there's got to be a reason for me to really go deep into somebody because it's kind of an invasion of privacy.
Yeah.
I don't need to go that deep. I do look at everybody in public when I'm out in public. I'm always scanning. I'm sort of a security conscious guy. So I'm always scanning for red flags, problems.
What would be a red flag?
Well, I can tell you a story that happened where I helped the LAPD capture a violent offender once.
Yeah.
Would you like to hear that?
Yeah, I'd love to, yeah.
All right, so it was in the summer a few years ago, and I was teaching a class, a workshop in Los Angeles. And the place, the neighborhood where I was teaching it, had a kind of a school environment. And that I was on my way to class when I came across paths with a man who looked like a homeless person. And you have a lot of vagrants and mm-hmm. homeless people walking around the neighborhoods in LA. And this one was no different. But I only just barely glanced at the man as I passed him. And the minute I did, I just, of course, looked at his face and then walked on. About a half a dozen red flags went up in my head.
Uh-huh.
I said, oh, we have a problem. And I immediately turned around and went to go to the management of the property, the manager of the property. And I said, look, you have a gentleman over here and he's not well. He's really emotionally unstable. And I think he's probably dangerous.
I guess you can go into details of what you saw and all that, but okay. You just saw that.
So it's like that, the information is there. It's not psychic. I honestly don't believe it's psychic. I'm just trained in being able to see those patterns.
Okay.
Right? Just like I don't think that the Polynesian oarsmen were psychic.
No, they were trained, yeah.
They were trained to recognize the patterns and knew what they meant.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
exactly.
So I went and I warned the management, and I thought that would – and they went and did something about it. I don't know what because I was late for class and went back in. So several hours go by, and we were on our lunch break, and I was in my classroom talking to a few students who had wandered in when we heard a commotion outside on the street. And I ran out onto the street, and I saw the same homeless person walking away at a very fast rate, and some people, a little crowd gathered in front, and somebody ran up to me and told me what happened, that this guy had just come up to this woman while she was having a conversation with another woman and violently attacked her, like assaulted her.
Right.
And then started to run away. And so I went after him, and a couple other guys came and helped me, and we detained him. And the police came and took him away. But the question is, you know, what that, or the story was, something in his face had indicated to me, not only was he emotionally unstable, but in the same words I'd used to the management, was he was potentially dangerous. There was something in his face that told me he was about to erupt.
Can you just tell me what it is that you saw in his face?
It's pretty hard to put into words because it's not a singular thing. It's right. Not like there's a cue like that. Okay. It's never the same because, and I agree with other sociologists whose work I study and follow, that you can't rely on singular physical cues. That's why I don't think lie detection is very easy, because there aren't singular cues for lying that repeat themselves over and over. Everything is too contextual. Mm-hmm. And so you have to consider the entire picture. And so in any case, as the one with the homeless person that I saw, something in the context of him, his body language, his face, the whole thing, it was a perfect storm.
Right.
And I just, it was instantly, obviously, all my flags went up. And sadly, it was right. And unfortunately, they hadn't been able to permanently, you know, to get him away from the property. Or I was told later that they asked him to leave, and apparently he had come back.
But it's also the kind of thing that you would look at if you're going into a business deal with someone or some kind of part. You would look for, let's say, red flags or some kind of a...
Sure, absolutely. This is part of the work I'm very interested in, and the industrial psychology work I do, and in developing more effective screening tools for people to use when they're hiring. And corporations do hire me. I have been hired by many different people to evaluate candidates, applicants, you know, finalists, job.
So you're saying there's no real specific keys, like if some people have a strong jaw, they're strong-willed, would that be certain elements?
I think there's always trace things there, and that there's some causal, some correlation sometimes. Right. And when you tend to go down that road, though, then that's where you go back into phrenology.
Right.
And I think it's a pretty slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it leads to good, meaningful, long-term science. I don't think it leads to good psychological inference.
Okay.
I think it leads to probably pretty dangerous, you know, approach to understanding who people are.
No, your approach makes it very interesting, and I'm feeling, wow, so if you can help me develop my intuition into a science, and that I could then intuitively get who people are, that's more valuable than some kind of mathematical formula where this means that and that means this, you know? Right.
I'm skeptical that there would be a mathematical formula.
Well, not mathematical, but it's not a science. Oh, let me
no,
just
no,
ask.
No, but I know what you mean. I know what you mean. I'm skeptical that there is a mechanistic approach.
Right. And you're saying it's a real science of the intuition, of the feelings, and that can be validated because people get the same things from the same people. I mean, you know. But what about the lips, for instance? People have, in traditional face reading, they say that refers to sexuality, sexual desires. I mean, would you, you know, because the lips are such, well, the lips and eyes, but sometimes the lips are just such a prominent part of the person. Does that relate in any way to sexuality in your understanding?
Sure, absolutely.
Oh, it does.
Sure, well, because lips, one of the things is that the muscles around the mouth, on your face, some of the most complex emotional interactions all occur around the mouth, lips area, the mouth and lips area, lip area. So there's a lot. There is a ridiculous amount of information there. Mm-hmm. Now, and there may even be some starting. You may even start with this idea of what does a lip that's this big mean? If the upper lip is bigger, the lower lip is bigger. You know, you can sometimes start with that, but really what you're looking for is how have emotions caused them to come to hold, how have their emotional experiences come to influence the underlying muscular structure of their mouth.
Right.
And there is huge amounts of information in that, because none of us exist in a vacuum. So they grew up in an environment, they've been having some kind of emotional reaction, some kind of an environment. And you can infer that really just looking at their mouth.
Well, I'm just looking at the Drew Barrymore picture that you have on the How to Read faces.com website. And if I'm just kind of using my intuition from what you're saying, I would say, you know, looking at her lips, I would say the fullness of her lips makes her very sensual and sexual. But the way she has her upper lips slightly tense and tucked in would suggest to me that she has withheld that, or she's repressed some of that sensuality just by looking at the slight tension in her upper lip. Would that be something, or I mean, does that make sense?
Sure, it does. I think it's the beginning.
Okay,
like I said, you're practicing the beginning of your own response. You know, and then what you have to do over time, though, of course, is you have to learn how to continually double check against your own biases,
right,
your own impositions. And so that's what the practice is about. That's what the training is about. You have to do something over and over until you are free from the sort of you're free from those personal agendas and biases that might be giving you a misleading information.
So how long is your training? I mean, how do you do that?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
You know, nobody's ever figured out a systematic way to teach this.
Uh-huh.
So I don't really know. I think I do notice that different people, based on their own psychological makeup, can seem to pick up the process a little faster than others. What I've been doing is I give a free or nominally charged, I don't know, like $5 or $10 public lecture, mm-hmm. which is actually a 2-hour class. It's not an advertisement or anything. I do my best to give as meaningful and concrete as a 2-hour class in face reading to the public, and I do that once a month. And we use the meetup.com, and I do it in here only in New York and LA.
Okay.
But,
when is your next one? When are you going to be back in New York, or when?
I'm in New York now. Right. We're here in New York until November.
Okay.
And then I go back to LA. And right. So on the website, I think there's information about the meetups. You can figure okay. out
What's the meetup called? If you go to
meetup.com is Face Readers, Face Reading Readers. New York.
Okay.
Like if you type in Face Reading to meetup.com and you're in New York, it could only bring us up, I'm sure.
Okay.
And like I said, I'm sure the meetup information is somewhere on that website, that howtoreadfaces.com website. And then there's a workshop, which is a 2-day workshop, which is obviously very intensive, and I go through as much of all the sort of things I've been talking about, plus, you know, trying to give some structure to the psychological inference process, how to both looking at positive traits and negative traits in an individual. And so that's like a 2-day, 9 to 6 wow. event.
That's,
I think the next, the we only have one scheduled for New York right now, which is August 3rd and 4th.
How much does that usually run people?
$250 for the weekend.
I see. Okay. Okay.
I'm told that's not a lot of money for it, because most of these weekend workshops are very expensive.
And people taking that will come away with a really solid sense of how to really do this work.
I believe so, because I've spent years now trying to continually break it down into its fundamental components. And I'm sure I have a long way to go, and there's a lot of research left to be done. But I'm definitely making progress in this process, I believe. And so if you come to that 2-day workshop, you will definitely walk away with a set of tools. Everything I do, I always try to make it about tools and practices. Even when I do the public lecture, I always create a homework assignment, and I make that available to the people on the meetup, so they actually have things to do to work on. So clearly I'm not teaching something that's easy, mm-hmm. but for people who have a sincere interest in learning this, because as you said, it is extraordinarily valuable. So if they have a sincere interest in learning it and are willing to go through the steps to learn, to practice, then yeah, you walk away with a real new set of tools.
It sounds great. So we can find out on your howtoreadphases.com your next lecture in New York, and then your workshop, where to register for that, and go to meetup.com and look for face readers. Let me just ask you, I guess we can sort of wrap up, but as you, it seems like there's a sort of generalization, which I guess you've checked out with other people, but you say the right eye is how we convey a sense of what we see in the world. Is that what you say, starting?
Yes.
And
yeah.
then the left
the right
eye.
Side is,
yeah.
Yeah.
Left
yeah,
eye is
the
how
right
we
eye
see
is
ourselves.
Us looking out, and the left eye is us looking in at ourselves. So through the right side is sort of the right eye is how we see what we see in the world, and the left eye is what we see in ourselves.
I see. So now, does that have a physiological reference to the way we are kind of organized as human beings? I mean, that's not a cultural thing. That is,
you know, that's a really good question. I think that's going to be really interesting to study and research. It was Dr. Lincoln who came up with the 9 different channels or ways of breaking the face apart. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, even just again, like a couple of years ago, I said, how did you come up with that? And it was really through trial and error over and over and over again that he was able to determine those things. And they seem to be extremely consistent.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, it's exciting. It makes sense, but it's...
But it will take... That's a topic that will definitely take time to research and test. But, you know, all that is doable, and that's what I hope, you know, I will... If I don't get to be a part of it, at least I will be able to encourage.
Well, just like you say, the right side of the space is how we project ourselves into the world, and then the left side is how we see ourselves. Would that be?
Yeah, it's who we really are inside.
The left side is who we really are, how we feel about ourselves.
Yeah.
Did you ever see those pictures where they take the right side and they make it the left side, and the person looks totally different? And so if you're saying that if the left side was the same as our right side, if how we project ourselves out in the world is who we projected ourselves in with, you would say that would make a very dull person, because
it's very rare. It's very rare. I've seen it only in people who really do seem to be quite sort of superficial and insipid.
But doesn't that make us, doesn't this variance make us a sort of hypocritical, as in the sense that we're not projecting who we really are out into the world?
No, I think it's part of the beauty of life and humanity is that we're all very complex. Mm-hmm. We're emotionally complex. We have lots of layers, lots of depth. And it doesn't surprise me at all that, you know, living with people causes us to develop one set of protocols, and our inner world, which can be very rich and healthy or very damaged and scary, is, you know, going to be still, nonetheless, very different from our outer world.
Well, yeah, I just have one question about a public person, because it was sort of,
sure,
it's become this sort of, I don't know, I got really fascinated with the Jodi Arias trial. Do you know who she is?
Yeah, she was just convicted of killing her boyfriend.
Well, she stabbed him in the back 27 times and then shot him and then slit the guy's throat. But, you know, you look at her face and she looks, in a sense, innocent. Have you looked at her face?
I haven't studied her face. I bring it up and look at it.
Yeah, look at her face, because I get so many. She doesn't look like someone who would be like, that vicious. Obviously, she did it. She admits to doing this. It's proven that she did it, although she lied about doing that. For the first 4 years, she was accused, and then she said, oh, yeah, right. So, I mean, there's someone who's pretty normal looking, I would think. I mean, but there is something, I don't know, maybe I'm projecting this disturbed character onto her, because obviously she is disturbed. But, she has a big smile, and
yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting question. No, I think you're sort of right. Yeah. You're kind of heading the right way. She's not, like, I know exactly what a really dangerous person looks like.
Right.
Serial killers, things like that.
Right.
Psychopaths. She's not a sociopath. She's damaged. She's deeply damaged.
Do you see that in her face? You're saying that because...
Oh, yeah. No question. She lives in a deep state of perpetual... fear. Judging by her face, she has what I consider certain markers for, I don't know anything about her, but she has the markers of child abuse, sexual abuse, or some kind of abuse growing up.
Where do you see that in her face, or in anyone's face?
Again, it's a constellation.
Okay.
It's not if I point to a single line, that would be a very dangerous thing to say.
Okay, it's a constellation of feelings. Okay, so she has those markers. What else do you see in her face?
She is... so outwardly, she's very driven to try to be, to please and to appear under control. But inwardly, she's operating out of real deep fear and suffering from real bad esteem issues. Mm-hmm. So that makes her extremely malleable in the hands of a, strong personality. Right? The need to please, the need to feel like important and valuable is huge. And I don't think that, at least I couldn't, as a face reader,
right,
have predicted that she would do that. I could predict that she's damaged goods,
right,
that she's unstable, that things wouldn't, no relationship would ever be healthy with her in this state, who she, uh-huh, based on who she is.
Uh-huh.
That this is one of those examples where I don't think you could have looked at the face and predicted that,
right,
particular behavior. Just like with some of these, anyway, I won't go any further than that. But yeah, there are times where you really can predict.
Right.
Another time,
right,
you can.
Well,
it was a very interesting case. I wish, and I actually had a friend of mine in LA who used to work for the CIA. And he took one of my face reading courses, and he said, man, I wish, you could help them sometimes. And he even went to speak to some of his former colleagues in Washington, but they just don't want to be involved with this stuff. And the reason it all came up is, I don't remember if you remember this case, but there was, I think, and I'm not even sure if it was Afghanistan or not, there was a double agent that the CIA had recruited from the locals, and he was an intelligent guy, like a doctor or something.
Right.
And they had recruited him and turned him, and he had agreed, you know, to be a double agent and to go back in to, and in, you know, to the groups he was involved in order to gather intelligence. But when I saw his face, I said 100% this guy is going to turn on his handlers. And that was the guy who walked back in, and because he had developed, earned their trust, he was able to walk into the compound carrying an explosive vest. And I think he killed six or seven, you know, agents that day.
Yeah, I think I did hear, but you could see that.
That was an example of when you could see it. You know, and there's many examples like that. In this girl's face, I can definitely see that she's a challenged and disturbed individual. It isn't logical that that would have, you know, that that's what she, you know, was about. I don't think. I think at a deep level, she's somehow she got pushed.
Right, she got pushed. Now, if you look at someone like Obama, who seems to look very sincere, honest, but in a way he hasn't been effective as a president, I don't think. Maybe he has. I don't really follow him that. But do you see that kind of thing in, like, Obama's face?
I did a reading on Obama before the election, because I did a reading for people, a public reading on Romney and Obama. Mm-hmm. And I can't even remember everything I said now.
But
Obama
is
expert at one thing, and one thing most of all, that is being a politician.
He is really,
really a good politician. Yeah, I don't think that if he has been ineffectual, it's hardly his fault. I think if anything, everything he's been able to do is just a testament to what an accomplished politician. Now, you have to understand, that's not that. That's faint praise, right? Uh-huh. A politician is somebody who's just expert in sort of getting through the day and keeping the game together. And that's what he's really good at.
But he seems, you know, on his face looks, he looks like an honest, he looks, you know, sincere and honest, what I get.
Not from a face reader's point of view. He has all the trademarks of a politician, which is duplicity and manipulation and the ability to probably deceive with great charm.
Really?
But these are the skills of a politician, right? This is what a politician has to be able to do.
Okay. So you could look at someone, say to someone, you'd be a great politician, right? If you.
Well, he certainly is.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so, I think the fact that he was able, as an African-American, to get elected twice, it's certainly a testament to his political skill, wouldn't you?
Well, I don't know. I think people had hope. It wasn't, they didn't, weren't electing because he was like, you know, all those things. He was, they were electing him because, or I voted for him because I thought he could, you know, make things better. Maybe he has or maybe he hasn't.
The thing is, I understand that, yeah. But I think that was his skill. His skill is as in being a super astute politician is that he convinced all of you that he really did represent hope and change. However, if you did a cold read on his voting record for the, you know, in his entire political life, you would have to say, oh, he is not about hope or change. He is about maintaining the status quo. He is a true Democrat who believes that somehow the system can be saved if you could just work hard enough to make it, you know, to keep it the way it is.
Well, and, who, yeah, no, I get, I mean, I get where you're coming, but who has an honest face? I mean, maybe what actor or what, whose face do you look at that you in the public that you could say, oh, that person is someone you would trust? Or, you know.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, yeah. I think an easy answer is the Dalai Lama has an honest face.
You could see that in his face. He's
sure.
Okay.
He's pretty much what he is. Okay. He's not really trying to be something else. Uh-huh. He is. He's just what he is. I give you some examples, though, of public figures. Maybe it'll help.
No, it's, I like the Dalai Lama. He's, I met him once. Very beautiful, present being. I got a good feeling from him. Yeah.
Yeah, he has, sometimes when I teach the class on archetypes, I begin by breaking down the archetypes into the idea of wisdom, courage, kindness, sincerity, and humility, as five distinct archetypes. And then from there, I can branch out and talk about, over approximately 30 archetypes that, a lot of which are derived from Carl Jung's work, and then Dr. Lincoln added some and things like that. And so you can sort of really get a sense for where a person is coming from. Mm-hmm. So if you want an example of an honest face, sincere, I don't have honest as a archetype, but
sincere.
Guileless. So Humphrey Bogart.
Really?
Yeah.
He looks... so sad, though. He always had
He might be. I'm not saying he's not, but there's an example of somebody who has who's very sincere, very guileless, very just, I am what I am, and it doesn't even mean that he doesn't have dysfunction. Uh-huh. Right. I think Justin Timberlake has that kind of face. He's actually a very sincere, relatively guileless person. Doesn't mean he doesn't have problems and dysfunctions, but there is an example of a face. I would also, so I'm trying to go back and forth in history, but go back to Clark Gable.
Yeah.
There's an example. Come forward and look at Pedro Almodóvar. How do you say his name? The filmmaker?
Oh, the Spanish filmmaker?
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know what he actually looks like, but I like his films.
But if you look at his face, there's an example, relatively... sincere face.
Any women that you get? I mean, sincere?
I'd say an older one would be, example would be Sally Field.
Uh-huh. I could see that, yeah.
A more recent one, I forget her name. Her name is Frida Pinto. She's a very attractive young Indian actress. She got famous in the movie Bollywood.
Oh, I don't think I know who that is, but
yeah, she was Frida Pinto, I think, is her name.
What about Jennifer Lawrence? Do you know who that is? Who won the?
Oh, Academy? Sure, Jennifer Lawrence doesn't really. She's interesting. Doesn't fit it. Would not.
She's
fit in
much
that
more
category.
Complex, isn't she?
Yeah, she would not fit in that.
Okay.
Category. I would.
I get the sense. I mean, as you're talking and you're making these, I can get a sense of what you're looking at. I mean, I know it's a. I just had, if you take the Mona Lisa, that picture, is there something mysterious about that face as a face reader or?
What? Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. First of all, as a face reader, it's not a beautiful face.
Yeah.
A face reader, when you look at the Mona Lisa, what you see is, somebody who I call, a personality type that I describe as dogmatic, rigid, moralistic, right? These are not great qualities. Uh-huh. Somebody who, and if you spend some time with the Mona Lisa, do what we learned earlier, cover the left and right sides, uh-huh. so you can see really deeper into what's there instead of looking at the whole picture, which always confuses the mind.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, there's been different speculation on who that was, whether is that a self-portrait or is that, and I think it has my guess would be that it has a lot to do with his relationship with his mother, uh-huh. who I believe was based on his face reading, because I've obviously seen picture his self-portraits, uh-huh. that, he had a really horrible mother, a very manipulative,
right.
And angry, rigid, moralizing type of personality. And so his face reading indicates that influence. And I see that in the Mona Lisa. So maybe he's, I don't know, consciously or unconsciously working out those.
No, that could be. That's interesting. But if you go to his last portrait, his last painting, John the Baptist, do you know that painting?
Yes.
you get some suggestions of some of the similarities between the Mona Lisa, but you get something more refreshing, I think, there. What do you get from that picture,
John?
Or can you not, do you not know which
no,
one?
No. Yeah, just let me think about it here. It's interesting. When you look at the face, again, play with the face. Look at it left to right, you know? And when you do that, I think you'll see that some of that sort of those same unhealthy traits that I'm describing in the Mona Lisa still remain, but they have changed. I do think that the picture as a whole probably does show a shift or maybe even a maturity, but ultimately I would have to say that he's never really solved those issues.
Those emotional issues inside himself.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And you want to know something really interesting since we're talking about Da Vinci.
Yeah.
He was alive in the era when he was alive was in the heyday of physiognomy, the European version. So the Chinese have persisted with the face reading or the physiognomy. Right. But it was, as I said earlier, it's existed in every culture. And it was very big in the 1500s, 1600s, and then it kind of went out, and then it came back in again in the 1800s. But in the time of Da Vinci, it was very common, and it was even taught at some of the universities. And I found, I read his opinion of that face reading back in that day in his book. You know, he has his art note, his notebooks, right?
Right, he has thousands of pages of notes, yeah, right.
Right, right. So in the book on art and the artist, Da Vinci said that, I'm trying to remember it.
Oh.
He said, He didn't like anything to do with the that's what he called it. How do you pronounce this? Chiromancy or chiromancy?
Or chiromancy? Would ch?
Yeah, I've only ever read it. I know everything that it means, and I've never heard it said out loud.
Chiromancy. I don't know. How do you spell ch? What is it?
Chiromancy. It's a fancy word for palmistry.
Oh, okay. So he said he was opposed to that, you're saying.
Well, I'll tell you the whole quote, because the word was throwing me off because I don't know how to pronounce it, but I know what it is. Uh-huh. So we'll just say it's chiromancy for now.
Okay.
So he said, I do not concern myself with false physiognomy and chiromancy. Right. So physiognomy was the name of the face reading at the time, which is all of that, what your producer was describing, the kind of phrenological approach with, you know, eyes this big, nose this big, mouth this big, ears set here. So he said, I do not concern myself with false physiognomy and chiromancy because there is no truth in them. And this can be proven because these chimeras have no scientific foundation. It is true that the features of the face display a part of men's nature. It is true that the features of the face display a part of men's nature, their vices and complexions, and it is possible to interpret many other parts of the face in this manner. So, in other words, like I'm suggesting now, Da Vinci believed that psychological inference was possible. Uh-huh. But that this mechanistic approach, he didn't accept.
Uh-huh. Well, he's written the foreword to your book there. Sort of. No, I mean
it's quite good, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is good. I mean, it's sort of what your work is all about. It's really fascinating. I would love to take at least your introductory class. When is your next evening?
I can tell you right now, if I bring up meetup.com.
Oh, okay. Thank you for that.
And I look under face. When's the next public lecture, you asked me? June 15th.
June 15th, and that's on meetup.com. Where is it going to be on June 15th?
It's going to be at the Stanton Street Yoga Studio.
Oh, okay. I know where that is. Okay.
It's Lower East Side.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not far from where I'm living, actually. How are you liking New York? Are you enjoying it here?
How could somebody not love New York?
I don't know.
Greatest city in the United States.
In the world.
Sorry,
yeah.
L.A.
No, no,
LA,
it's a lot more interesting than L.A. I mean, L.A. has some beautiful beaches.
Has wonderful qualities and great people, but you can't compare the city of New York to anything.
Yeah, except maybe Paris or Rome, possibly. But I like New York. I've been here for a while. So, well, this has been really interesting. I mean, I'm happy you were able to fill in as a guest, and I think this is fascinating work in understanding who we are as human beings, the complexity and the community, because in order to read something in someone's face, we have to have some of that in ourselves, right?
Yep.
And so even the person that you saw all those red flags or that kind of dangerous emotion, there's something that is that each one of us shares a common psychology that, and it's the language of the human being of our emotional lives are written on our faces and in the expressions, the subtleties of those expressions. So,
yes, I couldn't agree more.
Right. So I think it's probably something every psychologist should probably take a course in this kind of understanding, you know?
Well, hopefully over the coming years, if I'm successful in my work, I'll be able to publish articles that can help, you know, be a part of that.
Well, if you couch it in a kind of psychological framework, I think it would be important for other people to understand this because we override what you're saying is our intuitive senses, our faculties to know, to feel, and you know, we project what we want to onto people as opposed to having a really unbiased exchange there. So I'm just thinking maybe I can get you to lecture at the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy, which is a kind of a organization that kind of combines new ways of psychological approaches. So
That's not hard. I'm kind of a wind-up doll. You know, I'm always happy to, you know, come out and share these ideas with people. And
So what's the best way for people to reach you? Is there an
the
email?
The best way for people to reach me is to reach my partner, Tarani.
Okay, how can we reach her?
She has an email, taranitan@gmail.com. It's TARUNITAN at gmail.com.
Okay.
And so.
And your website.
And the website is howtoreadfaces.com.
Okay. And that's. And you have some YouTube stuff out there under.
I recommend the YouTube channel. Yeah, the YouTube channel is just the word Face Reading X. Although it's so stupid, you know, when you search Face Reading X on YouTube, it assumes you meant the two words face reading. And it gives you those and it says, did you mean this? And you actually have to click and say, no, I want Face Reading X. Because that's the name of my channel. And that's a fun place for people to go because I have. I don't have much there yet because I'm putting stuff up, but I do have the intuition exercise up, and I do have what I think some people are finding interesting is a sample face reading. And my partner Tarni, she submitted herself as the case study. So we did I squeezed it down to 30 minutes, but I did a full face reading, and I kind of explain a little bit about what I'm doing and what I'm seeing.
That sounds
good. Try to make it as educational as
well,
I could.
Well, she seems to have a pleasant face. I mean, from pictures I saw.
Oh, when you see the face reading, it's quite interesting.
Okay.
I mean, she, like I said, she put her, it was very brave of her, because if I do a face reading, I'm going to talk all about who you really, what you've been through in your life and who you are. And so she, it really, you know, she put herself out there for the public.
Okay,
it definitely gives you an interesting insight.
I'm going to look at that, and I look forward to maybe on the 15th I could come down. And so
you're
Atma, what was your last name you said?
Degate.
Degate. D-E.
A-T-M-A. Yeah.
A-T-M-A.
G-E.
Yeah.
And the last name is a Belgian name, Degate. D-E-G-E. Y-N-D-T.
Y-N-D-T.
I write, if you're interested, I write a blog on organizational psychology at askatma.com.
Oh, okay. I'll look at that too. And let's connect sometime in New York, okay?
I would like that very much. I think I don't know where the show comes out, but I'm certainly going to want to learn more about what you're doing, because it sounds like very interesting and, like as I said earlier, important work. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Yeah, no, this is kind of stuff I'm doing. This will be archived on BBS Radio. It'll be on my website. You could link to it as if you want people to have a kind of very big overview of your work. I think we covered a lot.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. I'll ask Tarni if she can link to it on the website.
Yeah, definitely. And thank you. Thanks for sharing, your real lifetime of work, it seems like, you know.
Yeah, it's been a few decades.
Well, it seems like you're trying to dig at something that transcends the human being as we have been told we are, and you're getting people to understand this sense, this deeper sense of who they really are, this intuitive sense of looking at people and people knowing themselves. I think there's something to that in your work. You know, that's what I get.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're digging for something even deeper in understanding who human beings are. I think that's what I want to say. You know,
I'd have to agree.
Something like that. And you're still digging for it. I mean, but you're uncovering some amazing things along the way that are, you know, revealing. And I think you just keep going and you're going to find something deep down in there, some universal essence of human beings.
Well, let's hope.
Okay. No, I think you are. Anyway, thanks, Atma, for being a guest. And
my pleasure, Alan. Thank you for having me.
Okay. And thanks, Doug, at BBS Radio there for jumping in. And this is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, go to newrealities@earthlink.net. That's my email. And newrealities.com is my website for a whole bunch of articles, interviews, interesting things that are coming to New York. Thanks for listening. And who do I have coming up next week? Anyway, I'll be back next week for some interesting guests. And thanks for tuning in. Okay, good night.